Thank you very much, Mona. I will try to maybe combine certain questions, ask a group of questions to each of our participants in the interest of time. So let me start with three questions. The first to Prince Turki and has to do with President Shimon Peres of Israel's acceptance of the Arab Peace Initiative that has been initiated by His Majesty King Abdullah. Where do we go from here? Is an international conference a possibility? What are the next steps when it comes to that? To Ambassador Huda, you talked about the achievements of Bahraini women. What, in your opinion, are the major impediments to women empowerment, both in Bahrain and in the Arab world? Are they social? Are they religious? Are they legal? And maybe also if you can address some of the human rights challenges that also face the Arab world. To President Arnold, we talked about educational system that needs to have new content and teaches values of diversity and tolerance. Is that being done in the Arab world? What, in your opinion, do you see? Are there efforts that, as Mona talked about, that are geared not just at providing skills to enter the labor market, but are there also efforts to instill in people values of tolerance and diversity, and if so, in which countries?
I have not heard that President Peres has accepted the Arab Peace Initiative. What he has said is that he is willing to discuss aspects of the Arab Peace Initiative, and he mentioned that its sole, in the sense of its spirit, is something to be discussed. In commenting on that, Amr Musa, with his inimitable Egyptian sense of humor, said that President Peres wants to snuff out the soul of the Arab Peace Initiative. So Israeli leaders have to come forward and say, yes, the Arab Peace Initiative is the initiative that we will discuss with the Arab world and with the Palestinians and with the Syrians and with the Lebanese. They can't simply run around it and say some aspects of it or other aspects of it and so on. So the Arab world has made the choice for peace through the Arab Peace Initiative. It's about time that Israel responded in a similar manner and presented a serious view of that initiative. And I'm just another remark here in my statement about Shab'a Farms. There was a questioner who didn't leave his name behind him, but I can guess who it might be, mentioned what about the Golan Heights. Well, of course the Golan Heights is part and parcel of any effort to get peace in the Arab world, and I don't think anybody has to question or to doubt where Saudi Arabia stands on that, because Saudi Arabia has made that part of the Arab Peace Initiative and has stood by Syria for that purpose.
Arab women have come a long way. I don't really see any impediment in Bahrain, but girls are educated throughout the system. The only issue that I see is that once they finished high school, is basically they do not have, some of them do not have funds to go for further education. In Bahrain now, there are various scholarships that are made available, and it's giving a chance to the women who would not have had that chance to go out of Bahrain and study abroad. One of the major scholarships is the Crown Prince Scholarship Program, which actually takes students from the public system as well as the private system, and it has given great opportunities to these young adults to improve their skills and get the important education that they actually require. Thank you.
Let me just say that I think if you look at the record of what governments in the region have accomplished in a relatively short period of time in terms of education reform efforts at a policy level, I think the results have been quite impressive. You've seen in diverse countries, Jordan, Egypt, the Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, efforts to pursue reforms at the level of curriculum, of school reform, upgrading teacher skills. Most of this has been focused on precisely the challenges that we've identified, that is to say, the lack of quality in the education system and the lack of relevance of what students learn to the job market and to the demands of a global workforce. I think probably less attention has been devoted so far to the soft side of the values that we've been talking about, and that may in some ways represent the next horizon. I would also acknowledge and agree with Muna in her observation that the real big challenge now is how do you get the trained core of teachers and administrators that can actually deliver and administer in this reformed environment. It's one thing to put the policies in place, but unless you have the people to make it happen, the reforms are not going to achieve the desired results. So I think that really is the next big hurdle that is facing virtually every country in the region.
Thank you. The next set of questions have to do with what I'll call diversity, religious or gender. A question on the Shiites and the Sunnis in Bahrain and whether they have equal rights or not. Question about Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia and its relationship to Islam and to practices of Al-Qaeda. A question, you might like this, let me read it. This is a question directed at His Royal Highness. Your Highness, you are now sitting alongside a female Bahraini ambassador to the U.S. When do you think we will see a Saudi female ambassador to the U.S. or anywhere for that matter?
You want to go ahead?
Answering the last question first, I'd like to see one yesterday, not tomorrow. But I think it's a question of society and perhaps even sometimes the lack of courage of bureaucracies. And women have made great strides in the kingdom. When my mother married my father, at that time, women did not sit at the same table as their husbands in having lunch or dinner. They did not enter the room of their husbands without first knocking on the door and announcing themselves. And definitely not would they be able to leave the house without turning first to their husband or their brother or their father and saying, "May I leave the house?" Now, some of those practices, of course, have lingered on in some places in the kingdom and in other parts of the Arab and Muslim world. But in most cases, I think the issue of education, and particularly education, has opened the way for women to reach ambitions they have not even dreamt for, of not only during my mother's time, but during my wife's time. And a few days ago, King Abdullah inaugurated the new university for women in Riyadh, which is going to be the largest women's university in the world. In the present makeup of that university, there are 40,000 Saudi women studying at that university. The campus that is being built is to hold double that number and will offer education in all fields without any restrictions or inhibitions. And it is only through these efforts that I think women can reach the ultimate goals of whatever they set for themselves. And just a brief, as my very good friend and much missed ambassador to the U.S., Afif Safia, used to say in addressing these issues, I will telegraph to you a few aspects of the role of women in Saudi Arabia. There are more women graduating from university in the kingdom today than ever before, than men. They excel much more than the men do. Women have been elected to the boards of the Journalists Association, Chambers of Commerce, and other non-governmental organizations. The educational aspects of the university that I told you about is that it is run by women. The president of that university is a woman, and most of her staff are women. So these are just a few points that I wanted to mention to you. We have not reached nirvana by any sense of the word, nor will we perhaps in the near future. But the road is ahead is much better than it was before. And I think pretty soon women will not only occupy ambassadorial positions in Saudi Arabia, but even ministerial positions and perhaps even higher positions than that. And those who want to quote me on that, please go ahead and do. But it is an important issue, and I think the recognition that King Abdullah gives to this issue is indicated by the way that he has brought women into the public arena by attending women's affairs, like the inauguration of the Women's University, by incorporating in graduating ceremonies in other universities, the graduating classes of men and women coming out together, by appearing on television with the representatives of women organizations or societies or other women's groups in public and showing how he deals with them and talks with them. So all of that will hopefully lead to one day Ms. Nunu will be sitting next to a Saudi ambassador who is also a woman at future conferences. Wahhabism, just briefly, there's a very good book by a very difficult name for me, De La Longa. I think some of you know the book I'm talking about. I advise anybody who wants to know about Wahhabism to read that book. It's a very good analytical piece on Wahhabism. As you know, in Saudi Arabia, when somebody says Wahhabism, we say, what are you talking about? We don't consider we are Wahhabis, because for us to accept that would be like accepting that we have invented a new madhab or a new school of thought in Sunni Islam, which we don't. As Wahhabis, between quotation marks, we follow the Ahmed ibn Hanbal school of thought in Islam. And one of my favorite remarks that I make to Americans in particular is that I have the best of both worlds. I have a Wahhabi upbringing and a Jesuit training at Georgetown University. De La Longa. De La Longa. I'll get it to you. Okay.
We are all citizens of Bahrain regardless of our religion or sect. Bahrain believes in equal opportunities for everybody. It does not differentiate between whether I am Sunni, Shia, Jewish, Christian, or Hindu. There are Sunnis and Shias in every walk of life in Bahrain, from ministers to an undersecretary to ambassadors to bank managers. You see them everywhere. They own businesses. They are around. So I think what I'm trying to say is that we treat all our people the same. We don't have any differences in anybody, regardless of their religion or sect.
Okay, the question that is not directed at anyone, but I guess all of our speakers might want to comment on it. Despite all the talk of a clash of civilizations, what are the cultural and civilizational ties that might help the Arab world and the United States to see the place where they share similar hopes, dreams, and goals?
Please. Let me start by recommending to you Marwan Masher's book. It's an excellent exposition of that topic, I think, and it should be taught in all of the schools and the universities. But more than that, I think people have to stop thinking in terms of civilizations and begin to talk in terms of civilization, because we all come from the same roots. I've described this as a tree that has its roots deep into human history, and with its stem coming up and branches shooting off of it representing different cultures. And as each branch dies off, another one replaces it on top with new ideas and new values and new ways of looking at the world and so on. It's a continuous process. And if you think in terms of Islam and the rest of the world, without people like Ibn Sina, Ibn Rushd, Ibn Arabi, who is sometimes looked upon as a bit too far out of the accepted Islamic heretic, and things like that, and scholars like that, there would not have been a Thomas Aquinas or a Bacon or a Galileo or any of the other European scholars and thinkers. So it's about time, I think, that we should stop thinking in terms of multiple civilizations and start considering that there is only one civilization for all of us.
I think just to underscore the point that His Highness has made, I think that things like the Bibliotheca Alexandrina, which really illustrate and highlight this confluence, not a clash, but a confluence of civilizations, really need to be more widely known, more widely celebrated, I think, by all of us. And there is a common universal language, and it's not confined to science and technology, where we most frequently find a common basis for exchange, but in areas including the social sciences, including the arts, including the humanities. Anyone that is educated in only one aspect of society or culture that looks at a problem only in one context is really missing an enormous part of the picture. And I think good scholars understand that. There's increasingly a desire for comparative work, for international perspectives that reach across these so-called cultural divides. And I think universities and institutions like the Bibliotheca have important roles to play in helping to facilitate that kind of a bridge. But it's not hard work, because there is, just by the nature of scholarship and of the desire and quest for learning and for knowledge, a desire to reach across national and regional and cultural boundaries.
Thank you. I think it's 12:30. Dr. Anthony tells me that he has one last question, which he got that he would like to comment on. So I'll give him the last word, Dr. Anthony.
This one is as much a comment as it is a question, but it relates to the answer that Prince Turkey and Mr. Arnold gave to the last question about the class of civilizations and what are the ties with the implications being positive. On the commentary side, to bring forth the knowledge that from 711 AD to 1492, nearly 8 centuries, the language of science and technology was Arabic. The language of medicine and pharmacology was Arabic. The language of astronomy and also maritime navigational skills and prowess was Arabic. And we know that Vasco da Gama, when he got around the Cape of Good Hope, treading unfamiliar water, so to speak, would not traverse the Indian Ocean unless someone brought to him Ahmed bin Majid, who was the famous medieval Arab navigator from Oman. So those positive aspects there, in terms of people like Toynbee saying that he owes his greatest intellectual gift to Ibn Khaldun, and many others in sociology and political science have said something comparable to that. And more recently, through the Zoghbi polls, through Gallup polls that have taken many countries' views into considerations when he was foreign minister of Jordan, Marwan Muwashi will recall this, that there would constantly be that Arabs have and Muslims have a very positive impression of American education, American technology, research, science and development, and also the fact that together in the geopolitical areas, the mutually beneficial consequences of our cooperation during the Cold War, and then undeniably as well in terms of the energy component of economic cooperation that drives world material growth, well-being, and standards of living, and increasingly staring us right in the face, the challenges to international financial cooperation there, being in a global boat, so to speak, in a rising tide lifts all boats, and a sinking boat takes everyone down. So there's a degree of ongoing us-ness that few Americans are really aware of, let alone recognize and appreciate, that can more fully flesh out that particular question. Because the, and this is the comment that was provided there, more than a question, I believe, if I can read it, the focus being on educating each other. Might one ponder the implications of the extraordinary imbalance of Americans being educated in the Arab world outside of AUB and AUC and the American University of Sharjah and the increasing ones now in Qatar, with the fact that so many hundreds of thousands of Arabs have obtained their higher education in the United States. We have heard, for example, that there are a minimum of 400,000 Arab graduates of American universities, but fewer than 100 American graduates of Arab or Islamic universities, with the exception of the Islamic University in Medina for members of the Islamic faith there, and that this extraordinary imbalance has a lot to do with their misunderstanding one another. And we have heard as well that in Saudi Arabia's cabinet, for example, since 1975, this is more than a quarter of a century, there have been every single day more American-trained PhDs as ministers than in the United States cabinet, Supreme Court, Senate, and House of Representatives combined. There are any PhDs as such. And lastly, the point was made of, in the last year, how many people are aware that on 114 American campuses, there was held Islamophobic Awareness Weeks. Admittedly, there are 4,200 American university, and perhaps it's but a tiny, the minuscule fraction of the total. But when and where have there been held Arab-U.S. Relations Awareness Weeks? And might one ponder that as a campaign that those who are positive-minded about this relationship might want to give serious and favorable consideration to launch in terms of the best and the brightest that's at stake in terms of the U.S.-Arab relationship.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We've heard a group of truly distinguished speakers address some of the main challenges facing the Arab world. I think it has been an extremely rich discussion. I want to add my voice to that of Prince Turki in giving two simple but powerful pieces of advice that he invoked in his own presentation. The need to listen. I think we can all benefit from more listening. to understand each other, to do things in cooperation rather than in confrontation, and the need also to sometimes leave the drawing table and start implementing some of the many plans that have been drawn for the future of this area and that are still unimplemented for a very long time to come. I hope you will join me in applauding our distinguished group of speakers, and that concludes the session.